mainly a set of papers with Chris Hill and Richard Hill, two of which have appeared and some work in progress. I will say, however, that the work, at least from my point of view, was inspired by some work that I did with Sophia Domokosh on holographic QCD using ideas of ADS-CFT to try to study certain interactions at low energies in QCD that are related to anomalies, and then that led us into this other application, which is just involves standard model physics. So I'm going to start with a summary. I don't know about you, but I often sit through a talk and at some point I kind of fade out and fade back in. And at the end, it's nice to, if someone asks you what the talk was about, to be able to tell them. So I thought that I would start right at the very beginning, tell you what you should remember if you forget the details. Then I'll go into kind of a logical development of the talk, talking about low energy QCD. The focus will be on the Weston-Meno-Witten term, which of course plays a role in many both phenomenological and formal developments in field theory. And what we've done is a somewhat different treatment of it than has existed in the literature before, a more refined treatment, you might say. I won't explain the full details, but I'll try to explain the ideas behind that. And once we've done that, then there will be a number of consequences. One will be we predict a rate for a decay mode of a rather, probably to most people, obscure vector meson decay, which is actually measured and where we can compare with data. Then the main new interaction that we find involves neutrino-photon interactions in the presence of non-zero baryon number, and I'll tell you about how those work. And then there will actually be some comparison to data, which is not completely conclusive, but is certainly promising, which has to do with an excess of low energy events seen in the mini-Boone experiment. And I'll end by mentioning some other possible applications of this formalism and giving you a few, reiterating the conclusions. Okay, so before summarizing and concluding, let me just say that the main actor in this story is a sort of interesting interaction that mixes the electromagnetic weak and strong interactions. Of course, we know that in the standard model, there isn't any three-gauge boson vertex that involves all three different interactions. Two of the vertices here involve fundamental gauge bosons, the photon and the Z boson of the electroweak theory. The strong interaction component of this involves the omega meson. The omega meson is an isoscalar spin one bound state in QCD, which couples to the baryon current, the nucleon baryon current. And so this interaction is of a kind of peculiar type in that it involves a phenomenological bound state, you know, so this will turn out to be something that appears in a low energy effective theory. But in that low energy effective theory, and the omega is a spin one meson, which in some ways behaves like a gauge field, we will see that there is a term that mixes all three of these interactions. Once you have something like that, there are lots of things you can imagine doing with it. So one is you can look at corrections to neutrino scattering. Neutrinos coupled to the Z, if there's a vertex where the Z couples to a photon in the omega, and the omega couples to the baryon current of the nucleus, then you can obviously have events where you produce a photon in the final state when you scatter neutrinos off of a nucleus. You can also take this vertex and turn it around. So if you had a dense nuclear medium like a neutron star or maybe in a supernova, and you need to get energy out in the form of neutrinos because it's opaque to photons, then there are new processes where a photon exchanges an omega meson with a nucleus, which is a strong interaction, turns into a Z, and then the Z decays to neutrino and antineutrino. So you can convert the energy in photons into energy in neutrinos. So the summary, the thing that I'd like you to remember, is that I will argue that this term and a number of others, which have other implications, arises in the low energy effective theory of QCD coupled to the electroweak theory, and it really is just standard model physics. The way these terms arise is linked to anomalies. The most familiar expression of that is the computation of the rate of Pinnock goes to two photons. The interaction may be related to the excess of low energy events seen at Mini-Boone and have implications for both other neutrino experiments and perhaps for astrophysics, and that there are a number of other terms with a similar structure which make some new predictions for vector meson couplings.
For the previous scattering process with neutrinos, there's direct competition with straightforward Z exchange and a charged nucleus emitting a photon, isn't there?
Yeah.
So
there are a number of competing events, and when I get around to talking about this, I will claim that this is actually larger than many other contributions that one can imagine that produce a photon in the final state. I mean, the details of that has to do, I mean, the mini-Boone experiment has a number of standard model backgrounds. And there are things, in addition to a number of processes which I'll list later on in the talk, there are things like producing a delta resonance in the delta, the exciting two nucleon emission of a photon. There are things like you produce a pi naught, and in the case of the photons, you miss one. I mean, there's a whole set of complicated backgrounds. And whether mini-Boone is correctly analyzed or not is a subtle and difficult question. But the effect that I will talk about is a new effect which was not included in their backgrounds and seems to dominate over many other processes to think about. And I'll talk about that more in detail. All right, so let me go back and start at the beginning. So QCD at low energies is described by the interactions of its lightest particles, the pions, and if we include strange quarks, the kaons. But for the most part, I will pretend that we're working in a world with just two flavors. Now, these interact with other light fields, like the photon, the electron, the muon, and neutrinos, through renormalizable interactions. But of course, they also interact through non-renormalizable terms of higher dimension. And ignoring the weak interactions, the treatment of QCD at low energies is a well-developed theory, the low-energy effective theory of pions through chiral perturbation theory. And even though it includes non-renormalizable interactions, the expansion parameter, which is the energy of the process over 4 pi f pi, which is about a GeV, allows one to control the calculation and do reliable calculations, even loop calculations. Now, in addition to those non-renormalizable interactions involving the pions, there will, of course, also be non-renormalizable terms that come from integrating out the W and the Z. And those will lead to small, weak interaction corrections to that low energy effective action for the light fields. It's in the spirit of that low energy effective action that this discussion sits. But at times, I will write down things that involve massive fields. I will then imagine later on integrating them out to get terms in a low energy effective theory. Now, at somewhat higher mass, slightly below and slightly above a GeV, there are vector and axial vector mesons. The rho, which is an isotriplet, and the omega, which is an isoscalar vector meson, and then axial vector mesons, the A1 and the F1. These couple to the isospin and baryon currents and their axial counterparts, and in some ways, they act like gauge fields. After all, Yang and Mills invented Yang Mills theory to describe the rho, not to describe the fundamental gauge bosons. That came later. And this idea that you can treat them as gauge fields, of course, is part of the idea of the old idea of vector meson dominance. And it also receives new support from ADS QCD, where you can understand quite directly that these fields arise as a kind of mode expansion of five-dimensional gauge fields that live in a five-dimensional space, which provides a dual description of QCD at large n. So there are a number of ways in which you can think of those effectively as being like gauge fields. Now, in the limit of vanishing quark masses, and here I've let the number of flavors be arbitrary, although we'll mainly focus on two flavors, QCD has a UNF left times UNF right chiral symmetry. But part of this symmetry is anomalous. If you were to try to gauge this full group, you would find that the effective action is not gauge invariant, but instead has a non-zero variation. And this variation can be computed famously through triangle diagrams, where the quarks run in loops. And at one vertex, you have the current, and you're trying to test for conservation of that current to see whether it's consistent to gauge it. And you find that in the presence of background fields, there's a non-zero divergence. And of course, the variation of the effective action is proportional to the divergence of the current. So QCD famously has these anomalies in the chiral symmetries that would exist in the limit of vanishing quark mass. Now, on general grounds, as you know, argued, for example, by Atuf, there has to be a matching between the anomalous structure at high energies and low energies. So this anomaly has to be there in the low energy description of QCD. Now, the low energy description of QCD involves the pion field and a nonlinear realization of this UNF left times UNF right symmetry. And you can write it as a function of a field U, which is the exponential of the pion fields. Now, there are ordinary kinetic terms, and you can make those gauge invariant without any problem simply by replacing ordinary derivatives by covariant derivatives. So here's a gauge invariant coupling of the pion to arbitrary UNF left and UNF right gauge fields just by putting in covariant derivatives. So how do you know that there's an anomaly? Well, the fact that there's an anomaly and also the fact that this theory with just the kinetic term has a kind of fake parity symmetry where you take scalars to plus themselves and pseudoscalars to minus themselves without doing a space-time parity, which is not a symmetry of QCD, you know that there has to be another term in the action. And the missing term was found by Wes Cimino in an early study of anomalies, and then much of its properties were explained by Witten, so it's often called the Wes Cimino-Witten term. And it takes the form of an integral over a five-dimensional space whose boundary is our four-dimensional space-time. And it involves the trace of the fifth power of a derivative of U times U dagger. You can think of this as being proportional to the area of the image of space-time in the group manifold of the chiral symmetry group. So this is a well-known story. And it's also well-known that if you take this Wes Cimino-Witten term and you try to couple it to gauge fields, A left and A right, that sit in this chiral symmetry group, that a number of nice things happen. So first of all, you then find that you can't really make the theory fully gauge invariant. Rather, there's an anomalous gauge variation, and it is exactly that you would get from the microscopic theory by looking at triangle diagrams involving quarks. You can gauge certain subgroups of this without having an anomaly. Basically, any subgroup for which the trace of T left cubed is equal to the trace of T right cubed. An example of such an anomaly-free subgroup is the electromagnetic subgroup. So you can couple the Wes Cimino-Witten term to electromagnetism. And when you do that, you find that there's a coupling that looks like pi naught times epsilon FF, where F is the U1 field strength. And that correctly gives you the rate for pi naught goes to 2 photons, which you can, you know, compute microscopically in terms of triangle diagrams. And in fact, this comparison to experiment fixes the coefficient of the Wes Cimino term in terms of the number of colors in QCD. So this is an old and well-known story. But in the real world, there are effects which have to be included if you want a full description, including the weak interactions. And the gauging of this Wes Cimino term and the treatment of it is, I don't know, it's complicated and interesting historically, and I'm happy to answer questions from people who have looked at the details and want to know how what we've done fits into the literature, but I'm not going to discuss that in great detail unless you ask. But let me point out a couple of things that ought to, in principle, be included. So first of all, there are charged and neutral current weak interactions. In the real world, the subgroup that we gauge of that flavor symmetry is the SU2 left times U1 hypercharge symmetry of the weak interactions. That is not an anomaly-free subgroup of UNF left times UNF right in QCD for the simple reason that the anomalies in the electroweak theory cancel between the quark sector and the lepton sector. So you're not gauging an anomaly-free subgroup. The subgroup you're gauging is anomalous purely in QCD, but the anomalies are canceled by the leptons. So when you try to couple the Wes Cimino term to gauge fields, what you really should demand is that the action you find has an anomalous variation which has the right form to be canceled by the leptons. Secondly, there are environments where there is a background baryon or isospin density. such as, you know, well, inside a nucleus or inside a neutron star. And these lead to background values of the vector mesons of QCD. For example, the omega meson couples to baryon number. Now, it's massive, so it's very short range, but inside a neutron star, there's a coherent background of the omega meson field. Turning on such a background must not destroy anomaly cancellation for the electroweak theory, because gauge invariance is fundamental, and you have to have that no matter what you do to the theory, whether you put it in some kind of background or finite temperature or whatever you do. So when you gauge it, you should allow the possibility that you put in background fields for the vector mesons of QCD without destroying anomaly cancellation. So those two conditions allow you to work out, after a lot of algebra, a version of this gauged Wessumino-Witten term, where the gauge fields are the gauge fields of the electroweak theory, and you include a background of the vector and axial vector mesons of QCD, which transform covariantly under gauge transformations, but are not themselves viewed as gauge fields. Now that gives you a version of this gauged WZW term that includes both fundamental gauge fields and background values of the vector meson fields. And for two flavors, it's convenient to organize these into a vector and axial vector background fields. And I've written those in a standard SU2 notation in terms of the three components of the row and the ISO scalar omega, and similarly in terms of the A1, the three components of the A1 and the F1. Now, when you do this, you find that there are many interaction terms, and you might find it strange that there are all these interactions that you haven't seen before. I'll write down what some of them look like explicitly in a minute. I'm going to focus on some of them, which we've called pseudo-Chern-Simons terms. They have the form of a coupling between three vector fields, which involve an epsilon tensor and one derivative of one of the vector fields. So these are terms that link the parity of space-time to the parity of the vector and axial vector mesons. And they're related to true Chern-Simons terms, which have to be in odd dimensions. So they're related to them in three dimensions, because if I took one of these fields and gave it a background value, say well, this was the omega meson and it had a non-zero time component and some background with baryon number, then you'd have a three-dimensional interaction between these other two guys that looked like a three-dimensional Chern-Simons term. And they're also related to five-dimensional Chern-Simons terms by doing dimensional reduction. So here is a partial list of a bunch of new interactions that you get when you follow this procedure. And, well, you might think this is kind of crazy, but in fact, most of these are either uninteresting because they involve processes which haven't been tested experimentally, irrelevant, or in a few cases, interesting. So I'm going to focus on two of these terms that seem to be interesting and that they can be actually compared with data. So one is a coupling here that involves the rho, the F, and the photon. A is the photon. And the second is a term that involves that interaction I wrote down before, which involves a coupling of the omega meson to the Z to the photon. So let me say again what it is that we're supposed to do with these. We're working in the context of a low energy effective field theory in QCD. So even though I've written terms involving the W and the Z, we really want to get couplings for the light fields, the pions, the photon, the neutrinos. So, and in the presence of background fields. So we should really take these interactions and integrate out the W and the Z, replacing them by their propagators, which will give us factors of G Fermi, and their couplings to light fields. So for example, for the Z to the neutrino current. And that will generate terms in a low energy effective action. The second thing we can do is, so far I have treated the QCD mesons as kind of background fields. But I could try to replace them as fundamental fields in the low energy effective action and use those couplings to try to calculate processes involving them. This is not really a well-controlled approximation. It's a calculation in the spirit of vector meson dominance. Vector meson dominance typically works to about 30%, but it's not easy to calculate corrections to it. The vector mesons have masses which are of order 700, 800, 1200 MeV, so they're not really light compared to 4 pi f pi. But you can do this and try to compare with experiment. There's a long history of doing it. It's just not a terribly well-controlled approximation, except perhaps in the context of ADS QCD, where you can derive an approximate vector meson dominance in the limit of large NC in dual descriptions of QCD. So it's not under good control, but it's something that is often done and doesn't work too badly. So as a kind of sanity check that we haven't gone completely crazy doing this, we can look at this decay of the F1 to rho plus gamma. This is not the main decay mode. I actually don't remember off the top of my head what the main decay mode is, probably something involving pions. But it is observed with a 5% branching ratio, with a width of about 1.3 MeV. And you can take the coupling that we have derived here, which involves some some coupling constants. In this kind of vector meson dominance description, you assume that the vector mesons and axial vector mesons of QCD have universal couplings, and you can estimate the values of those couplings by looking at various decay processes involving rhos and omegas and such. So it involves G rho and GF, which are constrained by other processes. And then there's some energy dependence and dependence on the masses. Now, if you compare the rate that we compute to the measured rate, it requires the product of these coupling constants to be about 50. Actually, the experimental situation is not perfectly clear, so this is a very rough estimate. And although this looks kind of nuts, these are strong coupling constants, and this is not an unreasonable value.
Sorry? Is there a lattice determination of G sub F?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know what
there must be, because this is, you know, one of the first things that live lattice would do, the mask and the coupling to the current over resonance, right?
It sounds like I should know the answer, but I don't. Now, so the rate is not that precise a test, but there's more interesting information from the helicity structure. So you have F1 decaying to rho plus gamma, and these are all, the F1 and the rho are both vector mesons, and of course the photon is spin 1. So if you, say, fix the photon helicity to be plus along the decay axis, there are two possible choices. Either so the rho goes this way and the photon goes that way. Either the rho can be longitudinally or transversely polarized, corresponding to the two possible spin choices of the F1. It can either be transverse or longitudinal along the decay axis. So you can compute the ratio of those two decays in which the rho in its rest frame is longitudinally or transversely polarized, and you find that the ratio is 2.8. Now, there are earlier calculations using the quark model, both of this decay process and the polarization structure, and the best one seems to be by Babcock and Rosner, my colleague John Rosner. And they found that the decay was purely longitudinal, and they found a rate which disagrees with experiment by about a factor of 12. So their calculation really doesn't work very well, as John would say. The experimental situation is a bit confused, but it's interesting. If you look in the PDG, and, you know, being a string theorist, I kind of assumed that everything in the PDG was absolutely correct and, you know, very naive and thought everything was understood. But when you actually start looking into these things, you find that things are often obscure and complicated, just like everything else. So the primary reference for this decay has conflicting statements about the polarization structure of the rho. And if you contact them, they really don't know who is responsible for that analysis. They're probably not in physics anymore. But there's another experiment which the PDG does not list as the primary reference, but it does list it. It's a Russian experiment by Amlin et al. And they give the ratio of the longitudinal to transverse decay rates is 3.9 plus or minus 0.9 plus or minus 1.0. So our theoretical calculation is certainly within one standard deviation of that result. And so that's sort of the situation. We get a rate that agrees within about a factor of 2 with reasonable values for the parameters. We get a polarization structure which agrees with this experimental result. And there are other terms which predict decay modes and rates and polarization structures for things that have not been observed yet. And there is some new data coming out from Clio, I believe, which might be relevant to the polarization structure of this F1 decay. So, well, that's the way it is. We have a new way of calculating this decay. We claim that it's dominated by this anomalous interaction. It seems to agree pretty well with experiment, but the experimental situation is not definitive. All right, now let me focus on the term that I think is more interesting, but I wanted to at least present some, you know, justification that we weren't going completely astray. And that's this term that links the weak, strong electromagnetic interactions. Now, there's something interesting to note about this. So the omega, I said, couples to baryon number. So if you viewed the omega as a gauge field that coupled to the baryon number is would sort of come out in some kind of ADS QCD description, then this interaction is not invariant under a baryon gauge transformation. That is, if you took omega and buried it by the derivative of some scalar function. Now, you might also complain that it's not invariant under gauge transformations of the Z, but what I haven't explained to you is you should think of this Z as a kind of Struckelberg field. It's really Z minus the derivative of the Higgs field, so it's gauge invariant for a massive Z. But
as a point vertex, until what momenta are you considering a point like?
Well, I'll get to that, but I mean, there are certainly form factor effects that come in when you get close to the GEV. And so.
But you don't know.
No, no, you don't know. You don't know precisely because this, as I'll discuss in a minute, this interaction is interesting precisely in the regime where it's hardest to compute it absolutely reliably. But let me first make a theoretical point, which is that it's not invariant under this baryon gauge transformation. And this is a reflection of the fact that the baryon current is anomalous in the standard model. That's a well-known fact. You know, if you compute the divergence of the baryon current in the standard model, there are triangle diagrams where at these vertices you put SU2 left times U1Y gauge fields, and you find that the divergence of the baryon current is not zero. And this is well known. At low energies, it leads to baryon violation by weak instantons, which are very, very small effects. But at finite temperatures, it can play a more important role and, you know, shows up in various scenarios for weak scale baryogenesis. So I want to make the point that this interaction is actually working exactly as it should and could have been predicted simply from the fact that the baryon current is anomalous in the standard model. There has to therefore be a term that links any field that couples to the baryon current to the electroweak gauge bosons. And that's exactly what this term does. All right, so how can we test this anomalous interaction? Well, we need a context where other interactions, such as electromagnetism, don't swamp the effect. If we want to treat it as a term in the low energy effect of action, we should integrate out the Z and replace it by light fields that it couples to. And that suggests neutrinos. And we also need a source that couples to the omega. That is something with baryon number. So you might expect to see the effects of this in the scattering of neutrinos off of nuclei where you produce a photon in the final state. So you can think of this as roughly analogous to the Primakov effect. The Primakov effect involves scattering of photons off of nuclei to produce a pi naught, and it tests this anomalous interaction between the pi naught and two photons. You use the nucleus as a source of electric charge to probe this vertex. So a very analogous thing would be to use the nucleus as a source of baryon charge, which couples to the omega, to probe this anomalous vertex through scattering of a neutrino off the nucleus. Now, this involves Z-naught exchange, so the rate will be very small at low energies, and the approximations used to derive this really break down when chiral perturbation theory breaks down, which is about a GeV. As you'll see later, the rate for this process goes like the sixth power of the energy of the neutrino. When you get above this, not only do the approximations break down, but various form factor effects should start to play a role. So you might expect that this interaction can be treated at least roughly reliably and be interesting and perhaps important in this sort of energy range. At higher energies, it's also interesting to know how it behaves, but it involves some non-trivial extrapolation, which is not under complete theoretical control. Now, luckily, there are current and future experiments that are sensitive to this effect, or at least close to being sensitive, that operate in precisely this energy regime. So the main experiment that I'll talk about is the Mini-Boon experiment, which uses a beam of 700 MeV neutrinos at Fermilab. And the Mini-Boon experiment was designed, I think, in part as a test of the famous LSND result that doesn't really fit into other experimental results involving neutrino oscillations. So they were looking for nu mu to nu e oscillations. And the way that they study that is by looking at, so if a nu mu oscillates to a nu e, the nu e can then undergo a charge current scattering to produce an electron, and that electron will produce Cherenkov radiation in this huge vat that's full of mineral oil. And you can compare that to charge current interactions where the muon neutrino does not oscillate by distinguishing the Cherenkov radiation from muons and electrons. So that's roughly what they do. And they see an excess at low energies. So this is kind of a busy plot. And there's somewhat more refined data available recently. But this is the number of events they see corresponding to what would look like nu mu goes to nu e. That is, what look like electrons in the final state. There are a number of backgrounds, which are in green and blue. And this purple is the expected background, and the black dots are the data points. And you see that when you get below about 500 or so MeV, there seems to be more background than expected. This is a plot, I guess, with the background subtracted. They don't find any evidence for oscillations when they analyze the data by putting a cut and only looking at it above a certain energy range. But this excess is statistically significant, and they claim it's 3.7 sigma. Now, I think since this was published, they have been doing a lot of work to try to improve their analysis, and this excess has gone down a little bit. But my impression is that it's gone down by about 10% and has not disappeared. So, what is the relevance of this interaction that I'm talking about for this excess? Well, it's an important fact that Mini-Boon cannot actually distinguish electrons from photons in the final state. They can distinguish electrons from muons. This is kind of a cartoon of what the Cherenkov radiation looks like. This is an electron, which leaves a little short track. This is a muon, which leaves a much longer track and gives you a much different shaped ring. One of the backgrounds to electrons is you have a pi naught decaying to two photons, and those two photons can then produce E plus E minus pairs, and those E plus E minus produce a ring of Cherenkov radiation, which really can't be distinguished from an electron. So here are two rings caused by pi naught go to gamma gamma, and each of these rings is indistinguishable from this electron ring. So what this means is that if there were events where there was a photon in the final state, they would be confused for an event that have an electron in the final state, which is what they're looking for to look for neutrino oscillations. So this vertex actually gives a background to the charge current events with an electron in the final state that Mini-Boon is looking for. This photon will produce E plus E minus, and that will produce Cherenkov radiation, which is, looks just like an electron. So could this be the explanation? Well, as you were asking earlier, you have to look at a number of competing processes. This is not the only way to get a photon in the final state. And this list is also not a complete list of all the ways that you can get a photon in the final state. And some of these are a little bit hard to see, but there are a number of processes you can look at, but they're all smaller than what I've listed. So there's also a coupling. You might say, well, why are you focusing on the omega? There are all sorts of other vector mesons that can couple to the nucleus. For example, the rho has about the same mass. Why don't you look at that? Well, it's suppressed by the fact that the coupling of the rho to the coupling of the omega is down by a factor of about a third. So in the rate, this will be down by about a factor of 10. What about pion exchange? There's also a vertex like this, but this is one of these kind of interesting weak effects that's suppressed by the fact that sine squared theta weak is close to a quarter, and there's a factor of 1 minus 4 sine squared theta that occurs in the amplitude. You can also have Bremsstrahlung, where you have a direct Z and then the nucleus emits a photon. But, you know, very heavy nuclei don't really like to emit photons. It's suppressed by 1 over their mass. And so this is also smaller than that. So you try to look at all these things, and there are other more complicated nuclear physics effects where you produce a delta resonance and it decays to a photon. You know, I'm not an expert on these things, but the things that we have looked at and the processes that Mini-Boon has looked at do not seem to completely explain the excess. And these processes, at least, are smaller than this process involving this omega Z photon vertex. So could this be the explanation? Well, you have to go calculate. And the most naive estimate, meaning one that a string theorist can actually calculate, would be to totally, you know, the simplest thing you could do is to ignore recoil, ignore form factors, ignore the fact that you're not scattering off of a individual nucleon, but over, you're scattering off a nucleus, and there's Fermi motion and all that. Just imagine you're scattering off a single nucleus, single nucleon, and replace the neutrino beam by a mono-energetic beam at the peak energy. So just to get a feel for how big it is, this is what you find in that calculation. It's proportional to G Fermi squared, as you expect, since there's Z exchange. There's a power of the energy to the sixth, the mass of the omega and its coupling occurs. And what you find is that for every 2 × 10⁵ charge current events, the QE is quasi-elastic, which is what Mini-Boon sees, you expect about 140 of these events with a photon in the final state. But it depends on the fourth power of G omega over 10. Now, they see 96 plus or minus 17 plus or minus 20 events. So getting of order 100 is roughly right. You might say, well, what's G omega? And unfortunately here, the literature is not great. I mean, I think this is a situation where lattice gauge theory actually doesn't give you a terribly great calculation. You can try to estimate it using various models for nuclear saturation. And, you know, and if you look in the literature, you will find values of G omega that range from about 8 to 15. So I would say there's a factor of 2 uncertainty theoretically in what the value is. And that means a factor of 16 uncertainty in this rate. So this is in the right ballpark. But without a better determination of G omega, it's not, you can't really nail it down. Now, there are more detailed things you can look at because you have more than the total rate. You also can look at the energy dependence and the angular dependence, and Mini-Boon does have some data on that. So here I've plotted the number of events, but I think not perfectly to scale. And that is, I've put data points and I've drawn a curve, but I have adjusted the normalization to please the eye. You could move this curve up or down an arbitrary amount because I told you that G omega is uncertain. But the distribution in energy is a function of the visible energy, looks about right, and the angular dependence is at least not completely crazy. Now, in comparing this to the data, I should note that the plot that I showed you, first of all, shows the number of events versus the reconstructed neutrino energy. But when they reconstruct the neutrino energy, they assume the final state is a two-body final state with a nucleus and a neutrino. I'm, in these plots, plotting it versus the visible photon energy and claiming that there's really a three-body final state, a neutrino, a nucleon, and a photon. So roughly what happens is the 700 MeV neutrino comes in, and you get some energy distribution in the final state between a neutrino and a photon, but roughly each carries half of the energy on average, and that's what you see in this plot. So the data from Miniboon as a function of the visible energy has a peak at about 350 MeV, and that is roughly what you would expect if you had two light particles in the final state in addition to the nucleus, which share the initial energy. So this kind of energy dependence, I think, also provides some evidence that what they're seeing is this could be this kind of a background. Let's see, is there anything else I want to say about that? Well, this is just what I was saying. In this plot, the nuclear recoil is included. So this includes nuclear recoil, and it also involves a simple choice of form factor. I think it was a dipole form factor at the mass of the omega, so about 770 MeV. What this plot does not include, and we're now in the process of trying to include, is since this depends on the sixth power of the energy, Fermi motion in the nucleus is an important effect, because if you have a 700 MeV neutrino and it depends on the sixth power of the energy, it depends whether you're scattering off of a nucleon that's at rest or coming towards you with an energy of 200 or 300, or I think the distribution actually goes up to, 800 MeV or something, although it's very, with a very small tail. So that has to be included in some kind of a Monte Carlo. And really what we would like to do is to do, we're not nuclear physicists, and I'm certainly not a nuclear physicist, but to include these effects at some simple level and then feed them into the Monte Carlo routine, is it Nuance, I forget the name of it, that Miniboon uses, and let them try to do the Monte Carlo to compare to the data. So this is a slightly more refined calculation than that rough estimate of the rate that I gave you, but it will be changed in some non-trivial way by things like Fermi motion. All right, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's not a definitive test of this, and this is not a definitive explanation of this excess, but compared to other possible explanations, which tend to involve quantum decoherence, neutrinos going in extra dimensions, and all sorts of other things, it's the most down-to-earth explanation. It's just standard model physics, but a subtle interaction which had been overlooked in the calculations of the background. It's also possible that this might be tested. So to test this, there are a number of other things you can do, although it's not going to be easy. So the Miniboon experiment also is taking data using a different beam at higher energy. There's a NUMMI beam at Fermilab, which has a kind of bimodal distribution of neutrinos, some at higher energy, and that gives additional information about the energy dependence. They also have data with antineutrinos, which, if this interaction is correct, should have the same excess. But I don't think they have enough data to really give definitive results. They also have proposed, but I don't think it's been accepted, an experiment that would use a different kind of detector that could tell the difference between photons and electrons in the final state. That quite possibly could definitively identify whether this was the correct process or not, but that's a hard experiment that I don't think it's been funded.
I mean, this effect would have happened in, at Sudbury or Super K as well, in principle, right? Is the fact that they don't matter due to the energy scale, the range they...
Yeah, what are the energy, what's the energy?
Well, I'm trying to remember. I don't remember.
That's standard EV, right? It's
yeah, I think it's...
Well, this is 100 to 1,000, so it's well below the
right.
energy scale.
Yeah.
That's, I expected so, something like that.
I mean, as I said, this is, you know, this energy range of, well, it goes to the sixth power of the energy. So you would like to go to, you know,
high
energy. However, the approximations break down when you get to about a GeV. And I mean, there are various ways of trying to extrapolate, but you're not going to get it, you know, dead on. So the sweet...
Are atmospheric neutrinos that low in energy?
But atmospheric solar. Neutrinos, it's not set for real.
No, I know. Super K is set as well. I mean, how what energy?
You can go to 100 MeV.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I saw Super K.
Well, I think T2K is the T2K experiment.
T2K.
Yeah. So there might future experiments might shed some additional light on this. There are other applications which we're looking at. So as I said, you can kind of turn this vertex around, and it could be relevant to neutron star cooling or supernova dynamics. We did a very rough estimate of cooling of young, very young supernova. Obviously, they have to be young, so they have to be hot enough for this effect to be important. And it looks like this competes with known processes, but does not dominate them. It might have an effect on supernova dynamics, but I mean, that's really a hard, complicated subject, and maybe some expert will look at it. It would be very, you know, no one has detected the coherent neutral current scattering of neutrinos off of nuclei. It's a very hard experiment because it's like looking for dark matter. You would have to measure the recoil of the nucleus. In order for it to be coherent, you have to be at sufficiently low energies, and then this process gets very small. But the fact that there's a photon in the final state makes it slightly more likely that you might be able to detect this. So we've been talking to people like Juan Collar about this, although so far it looks like the rates are very small. And another thing we've been thinking about is there are calculations of atomic parity violating effects that have been measured, something that I hadn't even heard of until recently. There's something called the nuclear aniple moment, which is a term that kind of enters at the same order as the magnetic quadrupole term. You don't learn about it in Jackson because it's parity odd, so it can't occur purely in electromagnetism. But when you have a mix of weak electromagnetic effects, there's this term. And in cesium-133, it's actually been measured by looking at the hyperfine structure. And it looks to us like this also gives a contribution to that, which has not been included in the theoretical analysis. So I think there are a number of interesting places where there are small, subtle effects that mix the weak and electromagnetic interactions. I think this way of looking at them gives a handle that has been missing and hasn't been included in the analysis. And it's interesting because it's probing a part of the standard model, which is very interesting and non-trivial, which is really related to the fact that the baryon current is anomalous in the standard model. You know, there have been attempts to try to probe that through electroweak baryogenesis, but this gives a much more direct experimental handle, not directly on baryon violation, but on couplings that follow as a consequence of the baryon number anomaly. So I guess I will end slightly early. So there are a set of standard model couplings. They are distinguished by their violation of this natural parity in their relation to anomalies. They give a reasonable prediction for certain vector meson decays, and I hope that this will be tested further in the future. And they may account for the mini-Boone excess at low energies, although this is not definitive. And I think they have some other interesting applications, both in astrophysics and nuclear physics, and in QCD. They're sort of, at the borderline of being detected, but in the future, they will either be interesting physics or at least background that will have to be included in trying to understand what we see, particularly in neutrino experiments. Yes.
It wasn't clear to me whether you predict the size of this anomalous coupling. I mean,
we predict it up to a coefficient.
which is this coupling G omega. We don't have a prediction for G omega. It's a parameter which governs the strength of the omega coupling to nuclei. So there's a coupling G omega times omega mu n bar again the mu m.
By G omega, you mean omega
I mean
nucleon.
Yeah. The omega
but nucleon. That's measurable experimentally, for instance, from fittings of the form factor of the nucleon to the isoscalar current.
Well, I'd be interested in hearing more. I mean, I've looked a little bit at the literature, and my impression is that depending on what experiment or what theoretical model you use to calculate this, you get answers that can easily differ by a factor of two.
Oh, well, sure.
Well, but the problem is the rate depends on the fourth power of this coupling, so that's a factor of 16. So, but as I said, you have more than the overall rate. There's the energy dependence and the angular distribution, and those, roughly speaking, seem to work, and more precise experiments might do that. So, we predict it up to coefficients which can be determined by other means but are not precisely determined. Yeah.
So vector dominance is a key thing in your analysis, and depending on the different people have, you know, different status. Can you sort of abandon this assumption and do some, at least have some predictions that would be valid outside of the vector dominance?
Well, I think in the analysis of the F1 decay, I would agree that I use vector meson dominance. In the study of this interaction that might be relevant to mini-boon, I really don't think we use vector meson dominance at all.
You do?
No. Because all we used was, you see, we derived these terms by imagining a background of vector meson fields. So you could, a number of ways of saying it, but
there,
in the presence of nucleus, there would be a background omega. Now, I mean, to get the form factor,
some people have, you know, very extreme point of views that there are no rows and omega in the T channel, right? That these are only resonances in the S channel, right? There's a different status relative to pions, right? Where you have a very clear scale separation, and you can have them in T channel, S channel, whatever.
I agree. There isn't a clear separation, and you could easily say, well, I mean, you know, there's a whole Reggie trajectory of omega, and I should just conclude this whole thing. But I think effectively what's done is if you were to sum up that whole trajectory with coupling constants, roughly speaking, you're just replacing that by some effective G omega and a single term. Now, that might not be a great approximation, but...
Well, another approximation, you can say that Z goes all the way directly to the nucleus, pulls out some quarks, right, and the quarks interact with the gamma, right?
That's essentially this Bremsstrahlung effect, and that's suppressed by the mass of the nucleus.
So you're basically saying that there is a triangle of a quark, right, attached by omega, right? But, you know... Well, maybe it's two quarks, right? You can imagine that there is a quark pulled out from the nucleus. But these energies, it's a field.
Let me give you another way of thinking about this, which I always find kind of convincing. Let's imagine a world in which the electroweak gauge couplings could be tuned as small as they like. So I tune them very, 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 very small, and I make them so small that the Z is lighter than the omega. Okay? Then I claim, just like pi naught goes to gamma gamma, you would see omega goes to Z gamma through this vertex. And in such a world, well, I mean, we can't measure that because we don't live in that world, but I claim this kind of anomaly interaction then would be completely, you know, legitimate, and you would see omega goes to Z gamma. And then just by continuity, as we crank the coupling up, there must be an omega z gamma coupling, which we can use to derive these kind of terms by integrating out the z through its coupling to neutrinos.
No, I have no problem with the z. I have a problem with the QCD part.
Well, you know, I think one could rephrase this in terms of matrix elements of currents in an office.
That's and, what we would like.
And then that's something that, in principle, should be computable using Flatiscation. And that, I think, would really be the definitive way to try to fix the normalization. So, but, you know, so yes, it depends on the fourth power of G omega and vector meson dominance, even when it works, when it works about 30%. But I still think this is the most plausible explanation of this excess, and is a set of interactions which have not really been included in an analysis of situations that involve mixing between electromagnetic and weak interactions. So I don't want to oversell it. It's interesting in a region that theoretically is murky, and we've done the best that we could with the tools at hand, but it's hard.
Any more questions? I'd like to thank Jeff again.